Hello and welcome to the Barton Legal Podcast. I'm Bill Barton, a solicitor who lives and breathes construction and engineering law. At Barton Legal, we help clients in the UK and around the world on everything from litigation and arbitration to drafting and negotiating contracts. And in this podcast, we unpack the latest legal trends and problems facing the industry, providing you with straight-talking insights to help break down these complex legal questions. So, let's get on with today's episode.
Hi everyone, I am Bill Barton from Barton Legal. We are specialists in construction and engineering. So this is part of our podcast series, but today I'm presenting Legal Bite Size, where I take a very quick look at specific areas of law, particularly in relation to construction and engineering. And today I'm going to be looking at the pre-action protocol system and that which relates to construction. As I say, this is all part of the Barton Legal podcast. And if you'd like to see other podcasts, do have a look at our website where you will find all the previous podcasts. So what is the pre-action protocol? This is how the courts have governed how parties are expected to behave before formal proceedings are started in civil litigation. They're designed to further the overriding interest, which is to help avoid proceedings altogether and obviously to reduce costs. These can be by encouraging communication between parties and possibly encouraging parties to participate in alternative dispute resolution, such as mediation. One of the key points you need to think about are the limitation periods, because the pre-action protocols don't actually change what are the statutory time limits. So as a reminder for those, if you have a contract and it's just signed by parties, the limitation period is 6 years. If you have a contract executed as a deed, it's 12 years, and tortious claims can generally be about 12 years. Now, the civil procedure rules, otherwise abbreviated to CPR, are clear that the pre-action protocol will not be an excuse for missing a statutory limitation period. So if proceedings begin before the expiry of the limitation period, but the parties have not had the time to comply with the relevant pre-action protocol obligations, they should still apply for the court for a stay of the proceedings whilst they effectively go back and comply with the pre-action protocol. It's also useful, I think, in this area to understand what is the overriding objective. So the overriding objective, as set out within the civil procedure rules, which has governed civil litigation since 1998, has this as an overriding objective, that all procedures and conduct is supposed to support and facilitate the overriding objective, whereby the parties to a dispute owe a duty to the court to help further this. The objective is enabling the court to deal with cases justly and at a proportionate cost. Parties should keep that objective in the forefront of your mind at all times, because this is a duty that we all owe to the court. What is the pre-action protocol and how does this actually help that overriding objective? So, if you engage in the pre-action protocol, it might help avoid later expense because litigation is expensive. It will also help you perhaps avoid or reduce court fees. It can minimize the expenditure and time you have with experts. You may well avoid substantial disclosure of documentation. You may not need to engage with counsel. And there are other costs as well. So if the pre-action protocol is successful, you probably won't need to issue your claim formally. Or even if it's not successful, it will probably narrow the issues so that your dispute is more contained. And that should hopefully enable it to be litigated over more quickly and at lower cost. As I say, it can also perhaps narrow the parties down. So you might have a multiple number of parties to a dispute, and you may be able to settle parts off. Most importantly, I think it enables parties to better understand their opponent's position and indeed to make sure that the case you're presenting is as detailed as possible. This means that things shouldn't come as a shock as you proceed through the litigation and everybody will be better prepared. There are, of course, penalties for non-compliance. So throughout proceedings, the court will have regard to the parties' respective compliance with the pre-option protocol. Two of the most likely sanctions that the court will impose for non-compliance are costs award against the non-compliant party. Even where they should otherwise have perhaps have recovered court costs, the court can effectively penalise you by saying you are not entitled to recover. Or where a non-compliant party has been awarded a sum of money, the court might deprive you of the interest on that money because the court's view is you didn't comply with the protocol and actually perhaps you could have settled at a lower amount or earlier or on some other basis and therefore will disentitle you to interest. Now, at the moment, interest rates are low, but at periods of high interest, that could be quite painful. What about specific pre-action protocols and how do they relate to different types of dispute? Well, there are different pre-action protocols for different areas of practice. So, for example, there's a personal injury one, there's defamation, there's one for construction engineering, and there's one for professional negligence. So we'll look briefly at the construction and engineering pre-action protocol. That, of course, applies to construction and engineering dispute. And as I mentioned above, this can include certain professional negligence claims. However, proceedings such as adjudication enforcement don't fall within the remit of the protocol. And that's simply because the courts have held that because the party's already been engaged with a dispute, the nature of it and its scope and extent is already understood by parties. So there's little point making you go through that sort of process. And hence, if you're enforced adjudication, you go straight to the court with no pre-action protocol. So the letter of claim sent by the claimant must have certain requirements. It should be sent to the proposed defendant, which provides a summary of the claim, the contractual terms that you are referring and relying on, and you must set out in fair detail the issues that are going to be involved. The claimant should include within the pre-action protocol letter the supporting documents upon which you intend to rely. So this is, in effect, a form of pre-action disclosure. And that is intended to allow the defendant to have a better understanding of the claim that is going to be brought against them. The defendant can serve a letter of response, but they have initially a 14-day period to acknowledge the pre-action protocol letter, and then a further 14 days in which to serve a full response. That's generally extended, and it's unusual for that not to be extended by the consent of the parties. However, if you need more than that 28-day period and the other side won't agree, you can make an application to the court, and it would be, in my view, very rare for a court not to grant an extension. But in that response, you should set out all aspects of your defence. And if you have a counterclaim, that also needs to be set out and included. And again, you're meant to provide the documentation. Now, it's quite possible that within both those letters, some documentation and some specific aspects of a claim or defence or counterclaim might not be included. And that's generally going to be okay. But if the matter doesn't settle and you come to issue and you introduce something entirely new, either into a claim, a defence, or a counterclaim, it is entirely possible that the other party will object and the court might send you back to comply with the pre-action protocol again because you didn't bring those aspects of the claim within that protocol process. So be very careful. What about without prejudice? Well, a critical aspect of the pre-option protocol is ensuring that the parties must make efforts to settle, resolve their claims. And there's an obligation within the parties to seek to mediate. That means some form of informal meeting between the parties. Now, that might be arranged directly between the parties with or without solicitors. It could be more formal, so a form of mediation. And the meeting can be dispensed with only really where it's disproportionate to the overall size of the claim. But it should be noted that the courts are very keen for parties to mediate. And if there has been a good opportunity, but the parties have not done so, that could be brought up later and used as a way of one party effectively penalising another. So during the pre-election protocol, you will have an exchange of formal documentation, but you'll also probably have an amount of without prejudice correspondence and discussions as parties seek to narrow issues and resolve matters prior to issue. But as I say, pre-action protocol comes before formal issue of proceedings. And if you don't resolve matters, you will probably use the substance and basis of your claim as set out within your pre-action protocol letter as the basis of the proceedings themselves. So, there you are. That's the pre-action protocol. If you've got any questions, do get in touch with me, Bill Barton from Barton Legal. Thanks very much.
Thank you for joining me for today's Barton Legal podcast. Please make sure you follow the show in your podcast app to get new episodes as soon as they're released. We'll be tackling another important topic in this month's Barton Legal webinar, and you can register for free and watch back our previous webinars at bartonlegal.com. Why don't you connect with me on LinkedIn and follow Barton Legal to keep up to date with all the legal trends and news. I look forward to speaking to you again in the next Barton Legal podcast.